Good morning, DFW real estate friends. In this episode of the Real Estate Heavyweights, we first take a look at the DFW real estate market statistics according to the MLS. Then we take a look at the real estate news of the day and ask questions like, I need to make how much to afford a house these days? Do we need a $220 million concert venue in McKinney? And what's up with all the gyms? After that, we turn the page on that beautiful smorgasbord of real estate content and bust out a delectable, unresistible, diabetic, coma-inducing level deep dive into the world of wholesaling, where we talk about everything you will ever want to know on how to buy a house from a wholesaler. There you have it. You can jump around or write it out all the way through. We are just glad you are here. And if you have not, please pause this thing and go leave a quick review or click on a few stars for us on Spotify or Apple Podcast. Copy the link and send it to a friend so more people can enjoy our world of real estate as much as you and I do. And now, let's hear that bell.
After the crash and everything else, you know, we ended up learning a lot of lessons and, you know, changed our spending habits and changed our mindset on money and things, right? And shiny things.
This is not, hey, this person is really trying to help me get my investment business up off the ground and they're helping me out. No, they're trying to move a house. And so a lot of them will give you information that looks really enticing.
You are now listening to the Real Estate Heavyweights Podcast.
You see this guy here staring back at you? That's your toughest opponent. Every time you get into the ring, that's who you're going against. I believe that in boxing, and I do believe that in life.
Your weekly deep dive into DFW real estate, life, and beyond. With your hosts, Tavis Westbrook and Ashton Hines.
Well, good morning and welcome to another episode of the Real Estate Heavyweights Podcast. It's a March edition. It is beautiful weather here in DFW and definitely enjoying this time of year. Nice and crisp. It popped up to 94 degrees a few weeks ago, but luckily has gotten back down to a sensible spring weather, and I'm really, really enjoying it. So I am Ashton Hines, one half of the Real Estate Heavyweights. I'm the newbie in the group. I've flipped four houses. I've got a long-term hold. I'm a realtor. I work with a lot of investors trying to find them great investment homes around the DFW area. We just closed a midterm rental for a friend now that has got a burgeoning business in the short-term and midterm realm. And so doing a lot of work in that area. The guy that is helping me out learned this whole thing, walking me through flips, walking me through how to comp houses, and now actually just a really good friend. And we do a lot of business together, talk every day about this house and that house that's popping up. What do you think this is worth? Let's go walk a house. So basically every day, just kind of learning something from this guy. It's Tavis Westbrook. What's going on, Tavis?
Hey, good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Do talk a lot now, don't we?
Yeah, we're just like two little teenage girls just talking away. You're a big talker though, because I know, like, you know, even when I you like talking on the phone, because, you know, when I'm in the truck or whatever, you usually have a conversation going on the speaker. So I think most of your day, it feels like, is spent on the phone with somebody. So
that is true. That is true. Yeah, it's funny, you know, because my oldest son Anthony, you know, he's obviously wanting to get into you know, the real estate game, you know, now, and has expressed a lot more interest, you know, after all these years, you know, now he's kind of ready, you know, and he's like, I have to learn to pay attention to more of your phone calls now and actually hear what you're saying versus just dad's on the phone, you know? So,
yeah. Anthony's a hustler, you know, and he's worked really hard in the service industry, and I know he can work. I think he would be a good wholesaler. You know, I think he could really work with people and, you know, be personable. And he has that kind of wholesaler's edge to him. I think he could really do well in that world. So maybe he will be the key to finding some off-market deals, which we are going to talk about today. That is an unintentional segue into our second half of our podcast, where we're going to get into the details of wholesaling. So before we get into that, why don't we touch on a little bit of a market update? Here in uh, DFW. Tavis and I were just looking at the statistics and really diving deep into the MLS and some of the things that were interesting and popped out. You know, we look at days on market, we look at average sales price, we look at the month supply, and overall months of supply are up over year over year. Since last January, we were about 3.2 months of supply, still technically a seller's market. Our average sales price the sales price off of the original asking is around 97%. And what we were talking about is that really does show that people are getting used to this interest rate environment. They're being able to price a lot more accurately. The other number that really hints at that is the shows to pending. And we fine-tuned that number, and it looks like it's about 15, whereas it was, I think, 17 last year. And so it's just less, you know, people having to come through before it actually goes pending, which does show a little bit of a seller's market. But it also just shows, hey, look, houses are being priced appropriately. Don't you think, Tavis?
Yeah, that was the... You know, that was a consensus here. As I'm looking at it, I was like, wait a minute, why is it down? But down in this category is a good thing. So, you know, at basically, you know, and we've talked about this before on the show. You know, I always look at like an approximate 10 showings to an offer, right? So, and that could be you're getting more showings. Maybe the offer didn't work out necessarily, but... This is showing us, you know, for instance, Collin County's 18.2 showings before going pending, Dallas County 17.3, Denton 15.7, and the entire MLS is about 15.5. So not far off from kind of that gauge that we like to use. And that could mean that, you know, there's a price reduction in there that, you know, allows these numbers to adjust. We're still seeing some price reductions, although... This is a good number. Again, the closer you can get to about 10 showings to pending is actually really good. So what this is showing us...
For a while, we were looking at median. That's where we fine-tuned. We were looking at the median shows per pending. Now we found average, and I think we always talk about average. So that's why we kind of adjusted how we were talking about it. But when you go from median, which is roughly 11 or 12, to average, we're around 15. So we'll start really talking about more of the average numbers here.
Yeah,
it does
there you go.
Raise it up a little bit.
Yeah. So what it's showing us, though, is that people are, you know, agents and sellers and everybody are kind of having a meeting of the minds and getting better about pricing. And now, you know, because we just had that crazy first quarter 2022 was just insane. Right. I mean, and people didn't really know how to price. They were just kind of throwing a number on the wall and seeing if it stuck. And in some cases, you know, that number would not only stick, but it would get bid up another 50K. And so when that happened, then you just started creating all this frenzy and leapfrogging, and somebody would say, oh, they got $50,000 more. So let's, you know, let's try to get more than that 50K higher number. And then they would push it up even further. Right. And so that was like what we were dealing with back in 2022. And it was just chaos. Mm-hmm. You know, we've talked about it before, but, you know, people see their neighbors sell at that high number, and then, you know, they're getting ready to sell. And it, how many of you lost track of time through COVID? Like it mm-hmm. blows my mind when I think back to how are we in 2024 all of a sudden. You know, it feels like 2019 was yesterday.
Yep.
And so I think that's happened to a lot of us, and we look back at what the market's doing, and, you know, it's like, oh, my neighbor just sold for, you know, $450,000, you know. It was like, yeah, but that was, you know, it shouldn't have sold for that. Maybe it, you know, maybe it still might sell for that, but I mean, you know, it's one of those things you just have to really dive into and pay attention to. And I think that's where a lot of these agents, and again, some inexperienced agents that just had some of the easiest jobs in the world to get a listing, not even mm-hmm. take professional pictures, throw it on MLS, put a sign in the yard. And, you know, people were so hard up because inventory was so low, and you just had people pull the trigger. So you get mm-hmm. people like that that just do not have very good experience in listing and selling the house, that now are starving and like so excited to get a listing and don't know what they're doing. So I think we're starting a trend back to more of a stable market.
Healthy. Yeah. Yeah, healthier, more stable market. You know, and we've talked a lot about it. Go back and listen to some of our other, especially during the Real Estate Heavyweights University, talking about comping, figuring out how to really comp a house. If you're an agent out there, putting it out there at the right price will make it sell quickly. You know, Tavis had his last flip, went over asking. And, you know, we have another friend, Rob, he has a flip out there. It went for a good price. So when you're priced properly, they're going to sell. When you're going for pie in the sky type numbers, it's going to be more difficult. And you always have to come through the process, basically thinking about the buyer on the other end. What is your competition? It's not just the house next door that sold for a crazy price per square foot, because there's a lot of other factors than price per square foot. It's smaller, it's a different style. Yours backs up to an electrical pole. Theirs is across the street. It's an interior lot, whatever it is. Like, there's a lot of factors. So you can't just look at a few comps down the street, price per square foot, do the quick math. Ours should be worth $900,000. You're really going to be in trouble there. So even as a homeowner, you can't, a lot of times Zillow, you know, when you're looking at your Zillow estimate, they're looking at some of that. That's mm-hmm. why it can be off sometimes, is they can only do so many math equations without taking into consideration some of the finer tuned things. They're like, yeah, I get where they're getting that number, but this one backs up to a busy road. This, you know, the one that they're looking at over there was just this ideal over the top flip, whatever. So there's a lot of things to take into consideration, but we talked about that a lot. And you definitely want to go back and hear some of our conversations on comping, because we've spent a lot of time on that. And Tavis is excellent at that. So, well, why don't we get into a little bit of news?
Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention?
From Dallas, Texas, The Flash, apparently official.
There's good news and bad news.
This is a massive story. Who wouldn't publish it?
We landed on the moon!
Man, I've got certain information, all right? Certain things have come to light.
And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
Speaking of home prices and speaking of Zillow, look, these seamless transitions today. But Zillow came out with their estimated income needed to buy the average house in certain markets. And last year, it's an insane article, because basically what it says is in Dallas last year, the income needed to afford the average house was around $59,000. Now it's $121,000 or something like that. And obviously this varies from area to area. They're looking at they might be looking at the actual county of Dallas or city of Dallas. So you have to dive a little bit deeper. But I mean, however you want to slice it, you need twice as much money on the income side to afford the average house in our area. And where we live up in Collin County and some of Denton County and even the north parts of Dallas, the average price is way higher than what they say is 360. You know, for us, it's more like 440, you know, some areas 500. So the income needed for that is insane. So either you need a lot more income, or like some of these buyers coming in from out of state who have equity in a California house, let's say, they are just putting a lot more money down to make the math work. And so anyway, I thought that was a insane statistic.
Yeah, for sure.
I am not jealous of the people who are out in the market buying right now. And so this also goes towards the statistics of, there's just not as many people out there, because I think there still is just this bewilderment of what am I even supposed to do? I'm selling a house and I want an upgrade, but you can't really afford an upgrade, or you need to save up a lot more money. And also that's why I'm going out to a new build neighborhood today out in Fort Worth. A lot of these new builds, and we've talked about this, they have a lot more levers to pull. And I found a new builder out there in Saginaw a couple weekends ago. They're offering a 3-2-1 buy down program off of FHA loan. And the FHA was starting somewhere in the sixes. And so they buy it down three percentage points the first year, 2 percentage points the next year, 1 percentage point in the third year. But that first year percentage was in the twos. So yep. If you're a buyer out there, and you're looking at this builder, you get a brand new house, you're like, oh yeah, and by the way, your interest rate for the first year is 2.9, second year is 3.9, then 4.9, and then we'll adjust in that fourth year. And everyone thinks, sure, we'll just refinance. Super attractive. You cannot blame the builders for trying. So if they have those programs, I think they could be super successful.
And you have to, you know, not to harp on comps, but again, And I bring this up because I got a lead on an opportunity. I believed I looked at it a couple days ago. Nevertheless, property was in Anna, kind of a new subdivision out there. Nice pocket. The subject property was built in 2019. You still got new builds going on right now in the neighborhood. And, you know, there was multiple factors, but this was a situation where this company bought out the seller and did kind of like a bridge type loan, you know, where they you know, basically allow the seller to, you know, sell them the property at a discount, use the equity and go into something else because they're, you know, they're excited about getting into something else. Right. So anyways, this company that did like that interim type financing owned the property. And I assume that they just don't have really a division to do any renovations because it was brought to me like, hey, it smells like dog. It's only a couple years old. And so I went out there and my math on it looked really good. I was like, man, I can maybe put 25K into this thing and make 20 grand. And this would be like a 30-day in and out kind of thing. And so looking at it from the numbers point, it looked pretty good. And I went and walked it and I was like, oh man. All right. So it was a 2-story. Most of the properties were all 1-stories in comparable square footage, about 2000 square feet. And when I walked it, it just had a really kind of funky floor plan. It just wasn't very attractive. Lower ceilings just didn't have a lot of attractive factors. And of course, my design brain's going and I'm like, how do I make this more attractive? And I'm like, before I dive into this, because I had them pretty locked in at a number that I thought would make sense. And they kind of gave me a soft number ahead of time. And I was like, man, this is great. I got back. I'm like, I need to dig into this deeper. So I dove in deeper. Well, one of the things that you dig into is my mindset was all the comps that were new builds were selling over 400,000. And so I dove into it and said, if I stay under 400 and I comp it at 395, they're listed right now on MLS at 380 and they're not selling. And I was trying to buy it for like 3.25, 330, right? And it sounded like that was a possibility. Anyways, diving into it, I'm like, okay, if I stay under 4, I'm good. Well, I look into it a little deeper and the comps that are selling over 4 are new builders, right? And if you look down at the very bottom, you see what the incentives are, or you see what the seller gave credits. And these credits were 15,000, 20,000, 20,000, 15,000. So now you're taking
the net price was 325 or 375 or whatever.
Well, yeah. So you take like a 410 sales price to a new builder and it's truly a 390 net price, right?
Mm-hmm. And that may not even factor in the 321 buy down stuff. So your actual monthly payment that they're bringing
just
into
from
that
what they're showing
different.
On credits, right?
Yeah.
And so that's something for people to understand. Like that's very important to look at that because appraisers will look at that and you'll see it in asterisk in the appraiser when he's comping value, but most agents skip that part. They don't pay attention. They just look at sales price or they look at dollar per foot and they use that number and they're like, oh, this is where it should be. And, you know, again, that goes back. When you and I first met and started talking, you had a listing out in Inspiration. Mm-hmm. And it was similar to that, right? Like you were trying to compete. You thought you were priced lower, but I mean, you were competing with these new builds and, you know, you weren't factoring in the incentives and the sales price minus the credits and things like that. So it's just important to really pay attention to that and know what you're up against. And they're hard to compete with. Again, their margins, the way they're leveraged. I mean, builders are leveraged pretty heavy and that leverage means that they have very little to none cash into the deal. So they can operate on smaller margins and bigger volume and make their business, you know, make sense. And so that's something just to understand with that world.
Yep. It makes it very tough to comp stuff in the new build area. But overall, the idea that Zillow is saying you need to make twice as much money to afford the average house, it's daunting, you know, and no wonder there's not quite as many people out there.
I mean,
looking,
I saw that come out yesterday and I saw a bunch of my loan officer friends, you know, say fake news.
Oh, really?
You know, here's one of the things I wanted to say when I read that article. I lived a short time of my life up in New England. In that area, home prices are much higher, right? They always have been compared to somewhere like Texas, right? You got less land, to expand. So, you know, the inventory is lower, you know, the homes are the homes. There's just not land for expansion and subdivisions to be built out and things like that. What happens is income that people make, the majority of their income goes to housing, you know, and you have a place and they drive used cars, you know, and
or take the subway or something.
Yeah. Like that. And it's not just because of, you know, the salt air and cars getting rusted. But I mean, you don't see nearly as many dealerships. You don't see nearly as many, you know, new fancy cars up in the world like that. Right. In New England, to where Texas, on the other hand, people change cars every couple of years. There's dealerships everywhere. People spend a lot of money here on their cars. I mean, we have car washes almost on every corner, right? Mm-hmm. That's something you don't see up there. And so it's just a matter of also how you spend your money. So like in a place like Dallas, the pricing is now increasing in housing. People are freaking out. They're just not used to it because they're
rebudget.
Yeah. I mean, Tabitha and I were talking about this back in 2009. We had a different mentality. We both made a lot of money as, you know, in our 20s. And, you know, I bought a $50,000 Lexus when I was 25 years old and thought, no, this is great. I could afford it because I could afford the monthly payments. Right. Mm-hmm. Mind you, the monthly payments were almost $800 or over $800 a month. I know that between Tabitha and I, shortly after I got that car, she wanted a Lexus too. And, you know, before I knew it, we're paying $1,700 a month in car payments, right? Our mortgage at the time, I think, was $1,100. You know what I'm saying? So like, but that was just, you know, we were into that mentality. I also had that very rookie mentality in real estate. Like, I've got to have a fancy car to sell real estate.
Yeah.
You know, we after the crash and everything else, you know, we ended up learning a lot of lessons and, you know, changed our spending habits and changed our mindset on money and things, right? And shiny things, and shifted our mentality to wealth building and budgeting and managing money, right? Is the correct word.
But in general, we spend a ton around here. I will definitely say spend a ton of money on cars, spend a ton of money on eating out. I don't know where the statistic was, but I do feel like Dallas specifically, and I would imagine Austin and Houston, you know, we spend a lot of money on our eating out and our disposable. So I can see where you're coming from there. It's like, look, yes, it does. Maybe we're having this reckoning of, okay, yeah, housing prices are going up. You're going to have to rebudget, and some of these other things are going to just have to become a little bit more reasonable in order for you to afford the house. And we've just been spoiled for a long time.
When Tabitha and I bought our home in 2004, $300,000 was like insane, right? To even think about. And I think we spent like $150,000 or something when we bought our house. And that was an affordable home, right? And now you've got the average price, at whatever you said earlier, you know, in the mid 350s, 360s.
Yeah, 360 overall, but where we are, 440, 450, something like that.
And it was insane to think about that, right? Like back then, it was like that is way over our budget. We can't ever imagine buying a $300,000 house, you know. Now, of course, we have rentals and midterms that are, you know, that we paid over that for that, right? we paid 300 plus for it now, you know, in today's world. But again, it goes back to where you're spending your money and what your spending habits are and what your housing, the allowance you're spending on housing versus other things. And so, I mean, I would argue a little bit of that whole thing today, saying you have to make, you know, whatever that number was, 118,000 or 100, whatever the number was.
I was going to go start delivering pizzas tonight, so I'll hold off on that. I'll hold off on that. So I'm glad we had this talk. So, speaking of spending disposable money, the concert world is a tad bit ridiculous. And I just actually not long ago had the conversation with a friend. I'm like, I don't know that I'll go to another concert for a long time because they've just gotten so freaking expensive. And, you know, there was some on the ticket, there was some no name kind of mid-level country guy was coming to town, and the average ticket price was $350. And it's like, how is that even possible? Well, to help usher in an even newer era of expensive tickets, the city of McKinney has announced a partnership with a concert venue company that is going to spend $220 million on a concert venue near the 121 and 75. I think they said it'll be a little bit east of 75 over there, kind of close to the downtown area of McKinney, which is cool. If you've not been there, check out the farmer's market. Really cool over in McKinney. But they're going to get a large concert venue, large in 20,000 seat concert venue. And so we were looking at some of the comparables. The American Airlines Arena, where the Mavericks play and the Stars play, where Tavis and Tabitha have season tickets there, and I get to enjoy a Mavericks game every once in a while. That is a 20,000 seat arena. And then the JEXA Pavilion, that's changed its name periodically, so we think it's JEXA still, but it's an outdoor venue, a concert venue, and it seats 20,000. So this is going to be right up there with some of the best concert venues in Dallas, and they're really hoping to get some big names. And we will see. There's a lot of concert venues now. You know, Toyota Music Factory over in Irving really made a push. Well, they're already doing a redevelopment of that. I think there's an article last week or week before, they're going to put another 30 or 60 into that to try to redevelop it. It's only been around 5 or 6 years. Unfortunately, I think it opened right before COVID. I saw Beck there. That's a really cool venue there, but it struggled a little bit. So I hope this works out for them, but you know, I don't know if they're trying to put a certain, you know, I don't know, certain area out of business or something, but I don't know if there's that many concerts that are coming through. And then the ticket prices that have to go with a 20,000 seat venue at $220 million are going to be up there. And at some point there's only so much money, you know.
I will say though, the location, putting a venue up here, you know, it looking at North, you know, in East McKinney,
yeah,
will definitely attract a lot more people that hate having to drive down and deal with traffic, you know.
Yeah,
and especially for that venue. The other really cool thing, I don't know if you saw in there, but they're doing they're offering up suites for one thing, but they're also going to do how many fire pits were they going to do? So they're going to a tremendous amount of fire pits, which is like super cool to think about, like just chilling with your family and having a glass of wine and having the fire pit going and listen to
S'mores
Dave
and
Matthews Band.
We'll just do that. We'll just do a big s'mores thing and Tay-Tay in the background. And now she won't perform there. She is she's an AT&T Stadium, 100,000 seat person. But
yeah,
I can't even imagine. I can't imagine spending the money to go to that, you know, type of concert, $1,200 on one ticket or something like that.
Oh,
but yeah,
gosh.
the fire pit idea seemed really, really cool. So I'm all about it. I would love to see it, you know, something there. Oddly enough, I've spent more money seeing stand-up comedians lately than I've seen actual concerts, I think.
Especially with growth moving north to, you know, up 75
and
the farther
Melissa,
that 289 gets built out and the tollway keeps extending north, all of that stuff, I think it's going to be awesome. So I would like to see it happen. I think that it would make it a lot more attractive if you're, for instance, if you live up closer to Sherman versus dealing with a 2-hour commute to downtown Dallas or to go to JEXA.
Mm-hmm. So one more piece of news and then we'll move on to our real estate topic of the day. I was shocked to see this statistic, and there is a certain segment of the retail space, and you're just normal, you know, shopping center, not commercial necessarily, not industrial, but your normal retail shopping center. A few years ago, this one segment took up 10% of the rents, and now it is taking up 25% of the square footage overall in the Dallas area for this category. And it is gyms, and gyms are everywhere, and they're, I mean, obviously you see them, but I did not realize that it actually constituted such a large portion of business for these retail shopping centers. And I know you have a retail center with 5 units. Y'all have a boxing gym, don't you?
It's a nonprofit style boxing gym, so it's not a super sexy retail spot like a lot of these gyms are that are popping up, right?
But I mean, just you're 20%. 20% of your space is dedicated to, you know, so that's so weird. I mean, but so what they're talking about in this article is that, of course, you have the big, you know, 24-hour fitness and LA Fitness. You have a lot of that. But the sort of micro gym, the real specific Pilates and bar, whatever that is, And then you have, you know, stretching labs, and you've got boxing gyms and kickboxing and F45, you know, kind of quick fitness, Orange Fitness, all, you know, these real one-off kind of certain environments. And actually what was, I thought, really interesting is there's a gym called EOS, I think, and they have a whole area in their gym with custom lighting and mirrors and all this specifically set up for fitness influencers to go there and do workouts and film their workouts so they can post it on YouTube and Instagram and all that. That's one of the things they advertise, is they have this area for a fitness influencer. I can pretty much guarantee you that's one thing I will never be, is a fitness influencer. But if I was going to be a fitness influencer, I may have to, you know, consider EOS. But I think it would be a really, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure, I guess there's certain people who make a lot of money doing that. But the idea of going to a gym, setting up a camera and filming myself work out for a while, I think would be an odd proposition. But all that to be said is there is a gym for everyone. I actually went to the boxing gym. That's the best shape I've ever been in, you know, going to a specific boxing gym for a while, and loved it. But I do know there's been several MMA gyms. You know, the UFC had a branded gym for a while, and it went out of business in several locations. So I know it's not a slam dunk easy business. But it's obviously paying the bills for a lot of these retail centers. So I thought that was a really cool article to check out. So, well, why don't we get into our real estate topic of the day? And we've touched on this a little bit, but we're going to talk about buying a house from a wholesaler. I've mentioned I'm dealing with a lot of investor clients calling, talking through the process. How does this work? How does that work? A lot of them are a little bit newer. And this is definitely a niche of the real estate world that a lot of people just don't know a whole lot about, because, you know, most people only buy a house every 5 to 7 years, and they're definitely not buying it from a wholesaler. So Tavis, you know, he wholesales houses. I've purchased a house from a big wholesaler. I've purchased one from Tavis as a wholesaler. We've had Brett Lane on the podcast. If you did not hear that interview, go back and check out the Brett Lane podcast. He works for Myers Home Buyers. And they have Trelli, the app, which is a wholesaling app. So we're just going to kind of walk through the process and explain some of the terms, some of the things you want to look out for when you're buying a home from a wholesaler. So from a retail standpoint, let's talk about how you even find a wholesaler. You know, for me, how I started getting introduced to wholesalers really was through Facebook. And when I really wanted to start looking for flips, I joined some local Facebook groups, you know, Dallas Investors, and there's 5 or 6 of them that are big investor groups in our area. Join those groups, and every day someone is posting, hey, I've got a 3-2 in Grand Prairie, it's this, this, and it's the Wild West, because one of them will show this much info and one picture, and another one gives you all the info and 30 pictures, and one of them wants you to call them, one of them wants you to text them or DM me. Like, it really is. There's no consistency on how they want to present the info or how they want to be communicated with. But anyway, I started getting on these lists. You say, hey, add me to your buyer's list. And so then I started seeing them on Facebook, and I started getting a ton of emails from random wholesaler A and random wholesaler B. And then inevitably you get on the big wholesalers list, New Western, Net Worth, you know, Myers. You start getting on some of these really big lists, and they are volume shooters. And so they'll 3 or 4 times a day send you an email of this house. So pretty quickly you can be inundated with wholesale level houses that you're trying to run numbers on. And then you decide, okay, maybe this is the one for me. So Tavis, why don't we kind of take it from there? We've started getting all this information in. We're seeing house after house after house. Let's talk about the process that goes from there to actually closing on a wholesale house. What would be the first step you would do after you get an email, looks promising, you know, then what?
Well, I think you got to back up a minute in the sense of, you know, we've talked about this before, but you've got to build your team. You got to make sure that you've got your lender lined up, where are you getting money, and your guy's ready to pull the trigger today. It means that you can sign a contract, ink it, have your lender working right away to make sure that you can meet the closing deadline. One of the biggest issues with wholesale deals is we don't know how long they've been marketed for or when the wholesaler actually got the property under contract. But a lot of times the closing dates are pretty quick. Like, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me today if we see some come through our email box and they want to close by the end of the week or, you know, middle of next week.
Some of them, it's the same day. They're panic. Yeah. They're panic emailing. You know, it's like, hey, deadline's today.
And you're like, it bounced back, you know, or somebody fell out and now they're trying to get it done. Right. So that's number one is you've got to make sure you've got a way to pull the trigger. And in fact, for me, buying wholesale deals are tough because I use bank financing. And so even though it's kind of a guidance line, a lot of times we need a valuation done for the bank. And that usually takes 2 to 3 weeks, depending on the evaluation time frame. And so it's tough for me sometimes to be able to make a wholesale deal work in the timeline. And that requires me sometimes to negotiate with the seller. Now, if you're using hard money or if you're paying cash, obviously those guys can operate, you know, quicker, right, in that sense. So that's number one, is make sure that you've got your money lined up and you can pull the trigger and you've got that figured out, right? It's important if you're exploring this to go ahead and make a relationship work with a lender or a wholesaler or private money or whoever you're using and go through the scenario. What if this happens today? What if the closing's next week? And what if I don't have additional cash to do the rehab? How does that work? Can we roll it in the deal? What does that budget look like, right? And so that way you kind of have an idea. Number two is who's going to do the work? Because time's money. And we talked about this before with you, Ashton, and making sure you've kind of got it lined up. Who's your GC? Do you self-GC it? Do you have trades available? And do you have an idea of what rehab is really going to cost? Otherwise, I mean, the wholesaler, a lot of bad wholesalers out there will advertise what the number is. The good wholesalers have got away from doing that now, and they're just giving you a yield. It's up to you to figure out what it costs to do the reno.
Sometimes they'll say, you know, they'll give you their 2 cents on the house. They'll say walks flat, roof looks like it's in decent condition, or roof was replaced in 2018, or, you know, all the mechanicals look decent. Unknown age. They'll kind of give you some of the basics there,
sure.
But yeah, a lot of them won't, you know, you'll see a lot of them say estimated rehab, 40,000. Like it's, how do you even, like, what does that even mean? You know, what are you doing? Yeah. Like, where are you getting, but they want to advertise. They're kind of throwing that carrot out there. And I guess the thing you have to remember too, when you're looking at these deals, one of the main things you need to understand is the person that is showing you this is representing the seller. This is a marketing company.
They're representing themselves. Yeah.
They're not representing you. That's what you need to understand. They do not have your best interest at heart. They want to move this deal. They want to make their assignment fee and go on to the next one. Now, the good ones want to have an ongoing relationship and they're not going to try to just screw you on one deal. But at the end of the day, they are a marketing firm that's either trying to move something for someone else or themselves, and they're trying to make a fee and they're trying to make as big a spread as they can. Yep. And so you have to go into it knowing that this is not, hey, this person is really trying to help me get my investment business up off the ground and they're helping me out. No, they're trying to move a house. And so a lot of them will give you information that looks really enticing. And hey, ARV is 800,000 and the buy price is 400 and the rehab's only $300,000 spread. You'll see that. $200,000 spread, $300,000 spread. You're like, oh, wow. You know?
Yeah.
So you have to kind of see through that.
It's the used car salesman, right? But he's selling you a junker. So basically he's saying, hey, I'm selling you this piece of crap car. It's up to you to figure out what to do to get it ready and get it fixed fix it up. And then you can sell it. And you're going to make all this money by taking on this beater and tearing it apart and redoing it. But it's up to you. And by the way, you got to do this. And if you agree that you want it today, and then you need to write me a $5,000 non-refundable earnest money check. You know,
okay, let's get to that part there. So let's kind of move down we're moving down. So you put your team together, know how you're going to pay for it.
You got your rehab. You got to make sure you know what you're getting into with rehab.
Yep.
And go back to watch some of our previous interviews because we actually dive into that a little bit and give you some rules of thumb so you guys kind of know what, you know, real costs look like. Here's one of the biggest things. Remember this. Most people get into wholesaling first before they ever flip a house. Okay. I myself got into wholesaling after flipping. So my numbers and what I know about, you know, that property and what I know is going to take to renovate that property, I'm able to buy it deeper and buy it at the right price, and everybody makes money. But most of these people get into this business and they have no clue about really flipping a house because they haven't done it yet. They know how to go find a deal. And they know how to make the matchmaker work, and then they build their buyers list, which is great because that's hard work. And that's a hard thing to do. We, Ash and I talk about it all the time. It's always about finding the deal. But once you have the deal, you got to have these pieces together. So diving into the next step would be how the contract works and what's to be expected. Money. Yeah. Earnest money and signing the contract. So,
and a lot of times you'll see that phrase is EMD. Like on the email, it'll say EMD, earnest money deposit, is $5,000, $7,500, $10,000. That is the money you will have to put up that's non-refundable to reserve the right to buy that house. And that's a huge difference between that and the retail market. In order to reserve the right to buy a house that's on the MLS, typically you're putting up $200, $400. You get an option period, 5 days, 7 days.
Well, you're going to put up earnest money too, which is usually about
1%. Yeah, but you could walk away. You know? You could walk away pretty easily for cheap.
Right, because you have an option period. And in most of the cases with a wholesale deal, they're not going to allow you to have an option period because there's too much time. There's too much risk. Most of the time, that wholesaler has it under option period themselves. Yes. And they secure you as the buyer and you're the real deal. And so now their money goes hard with the seller. Yep. So therefore, they're up against their earnest money being forfeited if you don't perform as the end user. So that's the reason that it's actually considered a non-refundable earnest money deposit. Now, the only thing that will really hinder that is if there's some kind of title issue or there's some kind of, you know, survey discrepancy or there's something to do with the property that is not the wholesaler's fault, is not the buyer's fault, and the deal falls apart, then that money would be, you know, hypothetically refunded as long as everybody's...
I've had that happen before. New Western, we put one under contract. It was up in Pilot Point. There was a title issue. Man, title issue, basically, you know, if you're not aware of that, basically sometimes people think they can sell a house. They have the right to sell a house. Maybe they inherited it from a loved one after they died. And they said, oh yeah, my Uncle Billy's always said I could live here for as long as I wanted. But now they're wanting to sell it. Well, Uncle Billy didn't tell you that he had several tax liens, and he had actually told three other family members that they could also have the house. And so the title company is sitting there trying to unsort all this stuff. And at the end of the day, they might say, look, this is going to take a while or going to take a lot more legal fees than this is worth. This is not going to happen. So then that's what happened. We got our money back. It was in the contract. If it went past, I think, 6 weeks or something, that if we wanted to walk, we could, and we could get our money back. So that happened there. So you put your earnest money up, you reserve the right to buy the house. And so, you know, now you have this house, you've identified it, you know how you're going to pay for it, you know the rehab, you've put up, you know, hey, yep, wholesaler, I want it. Here's my check, $5,000. Now what happens, Tavis?
So now you go into escrow, right? And a lot of times that check may... Some people required to go to title company and let the title company hold that earnest money. Other people required to go direct to the wholesaling company, the entity that's holding it. And basically going to escrow at that point, title work's going to get processed. Basically lending is, if you're using a lender, that process is going to take place as well. And basically all of that's going to start moving forward. The big thing to remember this is if you have an agent, and let's say the agent finds a deal for you or sources the deal for you, that agent is going to expect to make a commission for that, right? Because they help support the deal for you. They help, you know, source it. And therefore, the wholesaler is not prepared to pay that agent. And so typically what's going to happen is that number is going to increase whatever percentage that you and the agent work out that you're willing to pay that agent for their service in representing you, right? Yeah. So let's say that they're willing to pay you 3%. And in that case, you know, that number that you're agreeing to with the wholesaler is going to increase by 3% in order to cover that agent fee. You know, so that's typically how
it's done. Work that out before you get into it. Yeah. And I had that conversation with my investors.
Or you have a buyer rep agreement that's separate from the contract that basically is going to get submitted along with that in addition to the contract that basically says the buyer, in addition to paying $450,000 for this house, is also going to go ahead and pay Ashton Hines, you know, $9,000 at closing. Right.
Yeah.
And whatever the percentage, for their real estate services. Yeah. So that could be done too. But it's just important to kind of understand that. And if you're an agent listening, understand that you've got to have those conversations up front with the investor so that they know what to expect. And everybody should be happy. As long as your numbers make sense and you're calculating these numbers with that agent fee included, and you're backing that into your numbers and you're still happy with the return, everybody should be happy. It's just knowing, you know, nobody likes surprises. Nobody wants to get to a closing table and all of a sudden get hit with these big numbers. Another big thing to know and be, it's important to understand the difference. There's two different ways that a wholesale deal gets closed. One is by assignment and one is by double close. Okay. So what that means is assignment means I've got the deal under contract. Ashton wants to buy the property from Tavis. Tavis is the current buyer on the contract. And then I do an assignment agreement that basically is an addendum to that contract that now basically makes Ashton the end buyer. And the name gets changed, or I wrote the contract and or assigns. And therefore, Ashton's actually an end buyer that buys the property. And then I make an assignment fee that's on the closing. Now, typically the seller,
you're the wholesaler in the deal.
Exactly.
You're right in the middle of it. Yeah. You went to the actual person selling the house, the homeowner, you put under contract as a wholesaler. Then you assign that contract to the end buyer, the flipper, me in this case.
Right.
And you're kind of putting yourself in the middle and you can mark it up, you know, however much you want.
So let's say for easy numbers, let's say that I, as the wholesaler, go under contract with Mr. Seller for $100,000. Then I advertise the property. I put it out there. Ashton Hines is the end user buyer. Ashton decides he's going to buy the property from me, and I sell him the property or agree for him to buy the property or buy my right as I'm under contract. He's buying my right of being under contract. There's another specific word that I'm missing there, but essentially I'm under contract for $100,000. And therefore, he's buying it from me for $110,000. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, in the contract agreement and the assignment clause, it's going to show that Ashton is actually buying the property at closing for $100,000 now because he's the new buyer, but he's going to pay me an assignment fee of $10,000 at closing. So,
and the key thing to that is everybody sees all the numbers. Everybody sees how much Tavis is making there. And this is sort of the sticking point. Sometimes wholesalers don't want you to know how much they're making. And so they don't like to do assignments, you know, because on an assignment, you will find out what the wholesaler made.
Right.
And so, you know, that's why this other form is the double close. And so, you know, that's the other option. Well, and basically, double close is what it sounds like is it's two full transactions. It's you know, Tavis is opening and closing with the original seller, and then he's going to open one and close it with me as the end buyer. And on that situation, you don't find out what Tavis would make.
And there's another reason that double close exists, and it exists to make it cleaner on the first contract transaction. So when you agree to a seller that I'm buying the property for X amount of dollars, and then I do a whole nother separate transaction with you that says I'm going to sell you the property at X, you know, it's a double close, meaning it's going to be like a simultaneous close, but there's actually going to be two title policies and there's going to be two deed transfers. So in that case, there's actually going to be from the seller to me, Tavis Westbrook, you know, or my entity name. That's deed number one. That's seller policy number one. There's going to be insured title from that seller to me, and then I am now selling the property from me to you. So now there's going to be another title policy and another deed that's going to transfer. The key to remember when that happens, now it's cleaner with the seller, but what happens is the fees go up. And so what happens is you as the end buyer, typically your fees to close that property is you're now paying double closing costs because you're going to pay two title policies, you're going to pay amounts of attorney fees and escrow fees, et cetera. So therefore it's important to kind of understand that when it's a double close, increase your budget to allow for more closing costs because that cost will go up.
Yep. And then the last thing I wanted to talk about just real quick is, sometimes you will see, the same house advertised for different prices and it's called daisy chaining. And Megan is actually in town. They were looking at a flip down in Austin. It was, you know, they actually saw this house on the MLS. And then they started seeing it from multiple wholesalers for a wide variety of prices. And what happens is someone puts that house under contract. The original wholesaler will put it under contract. And let's say their option period's 2 weeks. Well, then they go to work marketing it. Well, they may market it to another wholesaler who markets it to their group. And so there's two or three people in the middle that are trying to get their fee. Mm-hmm. Or I think the other thing that can happen is basically the seller has a non-exclusive agreement. And they just, I think they can just say, look, yeah, y'all can all market it. It's, I'll sell it to whoever can sell it. It's for $450 or whatever. There's nothing that says they have to have an exclusive selling agreement.
Well, that's,
and so you can see it multiple prices out there.
That's when you hear people blow up right all over the social media platform. because they agree you've got a real bona fide buyer at the backside that wants to buy this property. And it turns out that the person advertising this property truly doesn't have it under contract yet. And so therefore, when you have a bona fide buyer that's ready to send the earnest money, ready to ink the deal, ready to close the deal, and then the seller is sitting there delaying you, you know, the wholesaler's delaying you and not signing the contract, you're like, what's going on? And it's because they don't have it under contract. So then they're going back, and a lot of times those deals blow up, or they come back, and because they didn't truly have it under contract, they're coming back to you now with a new price. And so that happens quite a bit, and it's ugly, and that's why they get a bad name. I mean, really, that's why you hear so much chatter and stuff, because really, you don't have to have a license to wholesale. And somebody watches some guru or, you know, something, or goes to some seminar and says, hey, this is what I want to do. And things blow up. So,
well, that's, you know, and the thing missing from my life is a wholesaler that's kind of a independent wholesaler that does their own marketing and knows how to comp a house, and who I'm on like a short list of five or six people that they kind of push it out to first. And we just kind of had this relationship. They're really good at finding houses. I'm good at buying them and flipping them. And I wish I had sort of that two or three of those guys that are out there that are just really good wholesalers that, but unfortunately I don't have that. I'm sure they exist. And then you have good companies like Myers who have their process down. They put their houses out on Trelli, the app. You know, there's definitely companies out there who know what they're doing, but there's so many people out there that are just trying their hand. They went to a seminar, they read a book. Hey, here's how you put something under contract. And I mean, I know that that happens a lot. Basically, you got to be careful. You got to do, you know, do everything you can to do your due diligence, do your research, but you can find good houses from wholesalers. So don't let this talk discourage you from trying it out, but just kind of be aware of what you're getting into. So that will wrap up our talk today on that little real estate topic. If that's interesting to you, go back and look at our Real Estate Heavyweights University. I think it was a 7-part podcast series where we really dove deep into flipping a house and buying and comping it and figuring out rehab costs and all that sort of thing. And that's definitely something you wanted to look at. If you have anything that you want us to talk about, please email us. Get on Instagram, Facebook, drop us a message. I'm Ashton Hines. I'm Dallas Real Estate Guy on Instagram. And Tavis is Tavis Westbrook, Travis without the R on Instagram and Facebook. He's got Tavis Westbrook Designs. I didn't mention it earlier. He's flipped over 200 houses. He's designed multiple houses. One of his houses he helped design showed up on this random Instagram feed of mine the other day, this mid-century Instagram feed. And they're like, hey, this is a really cool house in Dallas. I'm like, this was yours, right? So, and multiple people like, oh, wow, who did this? And so that was really funny to see his house pop up on this Instagram feed of mid-century homes that I follow. So please reach out to Tavis if you need any help with the design. We're always looking for houses out there. So if you have something that doesn't fit the MLS and you want to work with some guys that are looking for a flip, know how to walk a house, give you a really good price and make the process smooth, please reach out. That would be awesome. Until then, please go back and look at the interview we did with Brett Caldwell last week. We got another one coming up this next week that I'm super excited about. So pay attention to that, and we will check you later. Have a great day.